Welcome to the Egyptian Streets podcast. I'm your host, Noran Morsi, writer and podcast producer at Egyptian Streets. Each week, we invite a notable Egyptian to talk with us as we explore the intersection between Egyptian identity and creative social change from an artistic, educational, or cultural perspective. Hi everyone, Noran here. After today's episode, we'll be taking a little break and we'll be coming back starting mid-June, this time every Sunday. Keep up with us at Egyptian Streets Podcast on Instagram and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts if you've enjoyed the podcast so far. Back to the show! Today, joining me as guest co-host is Farida Sharawi, best known as the youngest Egyptian to reach Everest Base Camp. Hey Farida, it's great to have you.
Hi, Noran. Hi, everyone. This is Farida. I'm 20 years old. I study mass communications as a senior student at University of Hertfordshire.
Today, we're hosting Omar Samra, who sort of needs no introduction. But since this is our introduction segment, he's best known for being an Egyptian adventurer, the first Egyptian to climb Mount Everest, the Seven Summits, and also ski both the geographic South and North Pole.
He's also a public speaker, quite outspoken about his many causes, such as gender equality, refugees, and climate action.
Stay tuned. Welcome, Omar. We're really excited to have you today.
We usually ask our guests to introduce themselves, but since we know that you don't like to do that, I'll ask you instead. If there's someone that's listening to this podcast and doesn't know who you are, what's one thing you would want them to know about you?
I would say that I would want them to know that I'm a very curious person. I'm a person that's always prioritized doing things or learning things by doing. Rather than necessarily hearing other people talk about them or reading about them, I've always tried to, live a kind of life that as similar as possible to the heroes that I grew up reading about and getting inspired with. Sometimes we cannot, reach the same sort of levels of those people that inspire us, but it's a worthy endeavor to try and live a life that is full, a life that is beautiful, that is magical in a way. So while there was a lot of hardships on the way, I always tried to, aspire to push my own limits. And even if that meant getting a bit too far out of my comfort zone.
And I guess since we started at that point, I want to go back a bit and ask you, where were you born and what do you remember about those first few years?
I was actually born in London, in Wimbledon, to be specific. I was born around the same time the famous tennis tournament was being played. I don't remember very much of those years. I mean, actually, I was only in London for a few months before my parents moved back to Egypt. I would say sort of my earliest sort of vivid childhood memories was that of being a kind of a very asthmatic child, somebody who was not able to participate in sports because of my stamina and because of my lungs. That left me a lot on the sidelines in a lot of things. It made me very self-conscious of my own abilities, but also my own physique. I still am in a way, but was very much more very, very sort of skinny, lanky kind of, kid who didn't necessarily have any discernible athletic kind of qualities or talents. And so that was a big thing growing up. I was a very aloof child, very quiet, very shy, and tended to keep to myself. Had a very close group of friends, but wasn't massively outgoing or social or anything like that. And I think very much in my early days, I think once I was properly diagnosed with asthma, which was quite severe, that was at the age of 11. That's really when my journey began. Even though I was struggling with breathing and everything like that, my parents hadn't taken me to a doctor and hadn't been diagnosed up until that point. And it's actually because of certain people in my life very early on that I am able to be where I am today. The first one was probably the doctor who told my parents that I had to, in order to get better, I had to push myself, which is a very different rhetoric than what most of the doctors they'd seen had said. He's asthmatic. The cultural norm is, then if you're asthmatic, then don't tire yourself too much. Don't try to get out of breath He was very much of the school that I need to push myself so that my lung can expand and so on. So that was the first thing. The second person who's probably one of the most instrumental people in my lives, who's the fitness coach that kind of took me under his wing. We would train in the track at the Gezira Club. I'd have to show up at 6 a.m. 6 days a week. The first time I showed up, I couldn't do. He told me, just, you know, show me what you can do. Just, you know, just run around the track. I think I couldn't complete one lap, and I walked into the finish line on the first lap, like the last 100 meters. I was so unfit. And he sort of believed in me, and he was kind of like an early mentor. I mean, this athlete coach relationship, I think, is a very sacred one. Where it's a blessing to be able to have that kind of relationship. And I was very much, I trusted him a lot, and I basically just did everything that he said, even if it was painful, if it pushed me to the absolute brink. I was like I felt very much like a soldier. You know, it was a feeling that this guy believed in me. He saw something in me that I hadn't seen in myself. And because of that, I was willing to go to whatever lengths were asked of me. And so I made actually like really good progress really quickly. And within a few months, I'd stopped using a lot of the inhalers the doctors had prescribed, and began this long journey where I was able to actually participate in traditional sports like squash and basketball. And then my journey with mountaineering started at the age of 16 when I climbed my first mountain.
That's actually very, very beautiful. How do you think your Egyptian identity takes place here? Like, how does it contribute into who you are?
My Egyptian identity, I think, was very strong in the early years. Up until this point that I reached with the story, when I climbed my first mountain, I got to the top and I saw this little notebook, and it had the signatures of all the people who had climbed this mountain. This was in Switzerland, in not far off of Lausanne. And I saw there was, you know, people's names and the country that they were from. And I kind of skimmed through the book quickly, and I found that I was the only Egyptian making that entry. It wasn't a particularly difficult or high mountain, but it was a snowy mountain. It was the first time I'd seen snow. It was the first time I'd ventured into an experience like that. It was still like 2,500 meters, which was the highest I'd ever been until this point. And I felt very proud making that entry. It was in Switzerland, so they had a very, very neat sort of ledger of the people's names and nationalities, each person taking one exact line. And then I think my entry was in the beginning of a page, and I took the entire page up, like drew the pyramids and did all kinds of things, just ruined their system. But that was the first time that I felt like, at a very young age, felt like that I'm somehow doing something to represent my country, even though it was something very small. And probably had no significance to the outside world, but for me, it was a big deal, and it was sort of a crowning kind of achievement for me, having overcome all of these, health challenges to get to that point. Another big moment for me was obviously when I reached the summit of Everest, and I had taken the Egyptian flag with me on adventure pursuits, and that was actually before the whole sponsorship thing came into place, because once the sponsorship thing came into place and the activities and the adventures became something that had a public angle, that element seemed almost, not necessarily the Egyptian flag, but the sponsor mentions and the sponsor flags and stuff became necessary almost as something to be able to fund the pursuits. But even before that started, I remember when I went on my 1 year, 370-day backpacking trip around the world, that was very much something that was prevalent. But I think over time, I have to be honest, over time, it is not that the nationalistic kind of element became less. It's just that the more exposed I became to more of the world, to more countries, to more people, to more cultures, the more I realized that we're all one and the same. And this notion of, I am of one specific country, I represent this specific nationality with its specific traits and so on, almost dissolved. And I started to, while I was still very much, I'm still very much proud and celebrate the fact if I'm first, for example, the first Egyptian to reach this point or do this achievement, it did not become an end in itself. I think the adventures that I went on started beyond Everest, started to have more of a spiritual kind of element and start to have a bigger meaning. And I became less and less attached to the outcome of the adventure. So in the beginning, I will admit that with the Everest journey, I was very much fixated on the final goal of reaching the summit. And I was very blessed to have reached the summit on the first attempt. And if I hadn't, it would probably have hurt me a lot. I had sunk so much time and effort and resources into it that I would have been devastated if I didn't make it. But, you know, it's always hard to put so much time and effort into something and not reach your final goal, even if it's just from the perspective that to go back and do it, you're going to have to find the money again and find the time and everything else. But I think I started to realize, and especially when I started to fail at some of these adventures and fail in a very big way or not achieve my goal, I realized that I had learned so much from those experiences, far more than I had learned from the ones where everything went well. And then I realized that, you know, reaching the summit is not necessarily an end in itself. It is the pursuit of the thing. And then, you know, these specifics about, you know, whether I'm Egyptian embarking on this journey, it became more of this, I'm a sort of a human being. I'm just an individual embarking on this journey with my own story. So the Egyptian part just happens to be my story entering into this, but it's not the purpose of it. And the success didn't necessarily mean reaching that one specific point. I mean, the summit of Everest is, you know, it's the size of this desk that this laptop is on. It's just like, you know, 1.5 meters by a few centimeters. It almost doesn't make any sense to tie all of your purpose and, you know, or your feeling of self-worth and having been able to achieve something, but just by reaching this point. You can even get 20 meters from the top and not have to turn back for whatever reason. And you would, in that definition, you would be seen as have failed. But actually, I've come to learn that you may actually come out of an experience like that having gained so much more. And I learned this very much on Alaska and climbing Mount Denali, where I had to, it was the only one of the seven summits where I had to attempt twice to reach my goal. And I learned it in a much, much bigger way in my Atlantic journey as well, because obviously we didn't make it at all. So that was challenging.
You kind of touched on this a little, but I want to go back and ask you, what was that hardest moment in all of your adventuring journeys? Was it that Atlantic Ocean journey, or was it maybe something else?
I mean, they're all very, very different, because there's obviously very, you know, very difficult, very different elements, for example. And for example, the South and North Pole were very difficult for me from an emotional standpoint. They're obviously very difficult physical pursuits, but they were very challenging on an emotional level because they were just on the back of me losing my wife. And so to be able to go into such an extreme experience that has a lot of elements of solitude where there is nowhere to run from your thoughts and your emotions and stuff, that was very tough in that way. Even though it was physically challenging, I was challenged more by that than anything else. There was the experience that I mentioned in Alaska was very, grueling physically. But the challenge was that we had to come to realization that the elements, the mountain didn't want us to reach its top. You know, it was just and the idea that, you know, these things are far greater than us. And no matter how physically ready we are and how prepared we are, there is, you know, the nature, the mountain has the final say. The most experience that embodies, you know, what you were asking is obviously the ocean crossing, because, you know, this is something that was we reached the absolute, Omar and I, we reached the absolute brink. I mean, we came as close to death, I would say, that anyone most people would come. Most people that have witnessed the story or have heard the story, especially people who have a lot of maritime experience like sailors that have been sailing for 20, 30 years, will say that you guys shouldn't be alive. You know, it's the ocean equivalent of somebody skydiving and both their parachutes not opening. So we feel very blessed to have been able to go through that and live to tell the story. And again, this story is a wonderful example of how when things go wrong and when seemingly something has failed or didn't work out, that you actually might end up being rewarded with something far more. We ended up, we were rowing this ocean primarily because this is something that we wanted to do. It was my idea and I convinced Omar to do it. And we were both wholeheartedly working towards this goal, the idea of two men rowing this vast ocean against all odds, doing this extraordinary thing that, you know, once we get to the other side, we will live all of our lives remembering that moment, telling that story. And then once we knew that we were going, we realized that this goal is so big in terms of our lives that we need to attribute it to something greater than ourselves. And this is when we decided that we wanted that the journey had so much similarity and resemblance to the plight of refugees crossing dangerous seas. And so we ended up attaching that goal to raise awareness about the plight of refugees, a cause that is extremely important, that receives very little attention. Receives sadly less attention now than it did prior to COVID, just because COVID captures all of the headlines and the world's attention is far removed. But even then, it used to be a completely faceless issue. We have become very desensitized to what is probably the greatest challenge that faces humanity today. But this journey was very meaningful because even though we thought in the outset that our journey resembled the refugee journey in some way, we came through it to realize that actually it is very different to that. In some respects, it's the same, but in some respects, it's so different that it's almost an entirely different thing. We went into this journey out of our own volition. We had the best training, the best equipment. We weren't running away for something. In fact, we were running towards something. And when the only similarity really was in those 13 hours that we spent at sea fighting for our lives, not knowing whether we would live or die, that's really where it became our journeys became intertwined. But once we were rescued, it took us 2 weeks to get back home because obviously of logistics, and we lost our money and we lost our passports, but eventually we came home. So to think about the level of desperation, the will to survive, take their kids or venture what kind of situation they need to be in, what dire circumstance to flee their home, to arrive to a place where their journey is just beginning. So the crossing is just the beginning, where they actually may get to a place where they're treated unfairly or worse, maybe even sent back to the place that they were fleeing from. So for me, this is a massive issue, and it's beautiful to be able to do a pursuit that is pure, like adventure, and to do something like that, but find a way to be able to make it something more. We're obviously not claiming that our adventure or our pursuit will in some way, shape or form change the face of this thing, but it is a step, or it is a contribution. And we ended up making a movie about it, a documentary. And the beauty of the documentary is that when you watch it, you watch two people, Omar and myself, go through this harrowing experience, almost losing their life, and then obviously surviving. Obviously, I'm not ruining the movie because everybody knows that we survived, but you still feel all of the emotions. You see our families, our mothers, and you see the trauma and the emotion that is detailed with it, and you feel for us, and you realize, you know, these poor souls, you know, this is so, and you feel for our parents and you feel for our brothers and sisters and so on. And then the other part of the film is then juxtaposing our story with the story of a refugee family. And you might end up with the film wondering, how come you don't feel the same way for hundreds and thousands of people every single day in a situation that is far worse than the situation that we went through and is entirely not their own doing. Like, they had no choice in doing it. And to think that we live in a world that is so desensitized from that, that people are not necessarily thinking about that. It doesn't occupy is something that I hope that that film, which has screened in some festivals but is yet to be released, hopefully soon, was delayed a bit by COVID, hopefully will play a role in shedding some light on this issue. So adventures, basically, these pursuits, if you're passionate about something and you do it, even if it starts because you're doing it for yourself, eventually as you grow, it transforms into creating an opportunity for you to potentially use your voice or your platform to shed light or to support something that's more important.
We can also let our listeners know that the film, the movie is called Beyond the Raging Sea. It's not released yet. People are not able to watch it yet, right?
Yeah, the film screened as a work in progress at the Cannes Film Festival a couple of years ago. It then premiered in the Guna Film Festival soon after that. It also played at the Cairo Film Festival and screened in the Berlin Festival. It was due to be released in the cinemas in April last year, but obviously, COVID happened. So we're now actually discussing and hoping that this year we will work out the release of the film, whether it will be released through movie theaters, because obviously due to COVID, there's restrictions around that, or it will go in straight to TV or a video on-demand platform that's yet to be decided. But we're very excited for the film to be accessible to everybody so people can watch it, because, you know, we really feel that it sends an important message. It's obviously an entertaining survival story, but it's Marco Orsini, our director, was really did an amazing job in putting this film together, because most of the footage we had was lost at sea, and we never intended to make a film. So we weren't necessarily out there filming every single moment. So we didn't have as much footage as you would expect in a film, but we had less even than that, because a lot of it ended up sinking with the boat. So he did a phenomenal job of being able to tell the story despite of it. The trailer, though, is available. So if you write Beyond the Raging Sea trailer, it's available on Vimeo and YouTube, and it's worth watching the trailer if you want to get a feel for what the movie's about.
Very, very beautiful. I think back to the mountains and speaking of mountain climbing and your very rich experience into it, I'm pretty sure we can both relate on how beautiful connecting with the nature and with the culture, especially the Sherpans, for example, are. You also helped out a relief fund to Nepal in the earthquake event that happened in 2015. How do you find the spark of connection between you and those people that made you go to that extent where you have been an ambassador in the country and you've been exclusively helping those people in different events and in different timelines over the years?
Well, I always consider myself half Nepali. My Nepali friends sometimes think that I'm more Nepali than they are. I've definitely seen a lot of that country. I think I've been over 21 times to the country. It holds a special place in my heart because of obviously the experience of Everest gave me so much. It was a dream that I had as a child. It was the first big dream that I ever had. And at 28, I achieved that dream. And it was almost the pinnacle of my life. I never really understood the magnitude of what this experience would do for me afterwards. I only wanted to climb the mountain because it was my childhood dream. I never had any idea of where that would take me or what relevance it would have. So that's a big part of it. From the first time I went to Nepal, obviously several times before Everest, and I, you know, always fell in love with the people. After starting my company Wild Guanabana, I ended up developing also a business relationship with the people there, and we became family. So it's always very, very nice to go back there. I think the people in Nepal have taught me so much. I think because of the Buddhist Hindu kind of culture is a little bit different in a way that it's also in our culture, but maybe it's not necessarily embraced as much. This idea of being just happy with what you have and leading a simple life. I've always, when I go to Nepal, I always feel that time slows down. And, you know, me and my partner there, we always go, and when we meet him and I, we always engage in the same activities. We go and eat in the same restaurant. We have the same exact meal, dal bhat. We talk about the same things. And for me, it's in this hectic, super fast-paced life that we live here in the city, it's such a blessing to go back there and just realize that there's another choice out there, you know, that's always lingering in my mind, you know, of living a life that is where you're not always chasing something. You're kind of out of the rat race, right? Because they always say that, you know, in the rat race, you know, even if you win, you're still a rat, right? So we all seem to be kind of chasing something. There's obviously importance to chasing your dreams, trying to make an impact and so on, but we always have to juxtapose this with what we're losing and giving up. And I think COVID was a great time to reflect on all of that. The earthquake situation, obviously, because everything that I said and how Nepal holds a special place in my heart, when this happened, I could feel very much the strife that was happening and how much people were being affected. People that I knew personally in Nepal were affected, whether directly or indirectly through, you know, economic repercussions. And I felt that I had to do something. And I have this vehicle of travel. A lot of people think about travel and adventure travel as just a thrill, an adventurous pursuit, something that you do to have a good time. It is all of that, but it's also an amazing empowerment tool for development. And if it's done right, it can be extremely empowering to local communities. And can also send a strong message in terms of environmental sustainability and so on. Unfortunately, in a lot of cases, looking around the region, there's a lot of enterprise around that is purely centered around business and profiteering, which is an essential component, but it cannot be the only thing. So through that vehicle, we ended up going, myself and a few other people within the adventure travel community. We went there to see how the poor and most underprivileged communities in Nepal were faring with the earthquake and the ramifications of the earthquake, to see it firsthand, to talk to people and understand what was going on, and to basically tell people that Nepal is still open for business, and people should visit and they should not be afraid. And so I was just very privileged to be part of that. And because I guess I have been to Nepal so many times, and so much of my life has been intertwined with Nepal, that in 2020 I was given this honor of being an honorary ambassador to Nepal, and this couldn't have made me more happy. This country has given me so much, and I'm just so elated to be able to have the opportunity to give something back.
Amazing. And I think throughout everything you've been through and how generous you've been sharing all your experiences on social media with both personal life and all your adventures, one has to wonder how your family feels about you being passionate and pursuing a sort of career or adventures that sort of put your life at risk in one way or another. How do they feel about that? And was that ever sort of a conflict between you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And honestly, it's a question that I've gotten before. And it's very valid. I think when I was younger, I think I used to sort of get very defensive about this question because, you know, it feels like people are not understanding me or not understanding those people who decide to do these things. And so it's almost like it feels almost sometimes like used to feel like a negative commentary on what I do. But having obviously gotten older and a bit, hopefully a bit wiser and more mature, I realized that this is a fair comment. I mean, adventures, exploration, doing things that have an inherent amount of risk is a selfish endeavor at the end of the day. And it's for sure. But just in the same way that throwing yourself into anything in life can be labeled as a selfish endeavor. So, for example, if you're a musician, in order to create great art that is both meaningful for yourself and hopefully the outside world, this enterprise, this activity will consume you. Same if you're an athlete or you're a mathematician or you're a historian or whatever else. In order to, being able to achieve something or to achieve something that is the best version of yourself demands a certain kind of commitment. So that is a choice that we make, of course. But it's important that with that choice, there is a consciousness and a realization that there is a cost. The cost can come to your family, can come to your loved ones, because obviously this amount of time that you're away from them, and obviously if there's an inherent amount of risk, there is also that as well. So for me, I take it as a responsibility to do my due diligence. It's a responsibility to, if I'm on an adventure, to turn back if I feel that the objective risk that I'm facing is does not make sense anymore. And I have done that before, and I'm comfortable with making those decisions. And so it's this sort of balance. We're constantly in life doing these things on this kind of tightrope, and we constantly have to keep balancing this thing. The alternative is obviously to deny yourself your dreams, to deny yourself the things that make you feel alive. And that is not good for you, but it's not good for anyone else as well. Because if you are not fulfilled as a human being, if you do not feel that you are exercising your freedom and your rights and your volition to become the person that you're meant to be, then you will not have something to give. And ultimately, you will end up resenting circumstance, life, and those people who took that away from you. And sometimes this is just yourself, because you only have yourself to blame, because you put so much pressure on yourself, and this sort of not necessarily false, but this over-exaggerated sense of responsibility, that you are responsible not only for yourself, but everybody else's emotions. At the end of the day, everybody has their own journey. Everybody has their own life. And we need to make our own decisions and live by them. So this is obviously a very philosophical question. It's a very nuanced question. It's not a simple one. And it's something that I've thought about many times. And I think it's important to think about it and not to just walk through life disregarding it, or do like I told you in the very beginning, when I used to be very defensive about it and try to not to do it. So I think it's important, even if you're going to pursue the thing that is all consuming, that is dangerous, that is whatever, to do it with eyes wide open, and to understand the full picture, and to figure out ways to bring people with you.
I think you're making some really interesting points that I had never thought about before, really. That if you stop yourself from pursuing what you're passionate about, it's not good for you or for your family, because you won't really be fulfilling what you're supposed to be doing. So I think that was a great answer.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, what do you wish you knew 10 years ago? Or 5 years ago, before you were sort of advanced in everything you're doing, really, what do you wish you had told yourself 10 years ago that maybe would have made the journey a bit easier?
I think what I would wish I was able to do more is I wish I was able to ask for help and support. I think I was very much, I grew up in a way where I felt very much that I needed to rely completely on myself, that I had to go through my own journey by myself. And it was very difficult for me to ask for help. That also came into play with my business. When I started Wild Guanabna, I was a founder. I wasn't a co-founder. And I think that made the journey much more challenging. And I think it would have been easier, but also more rewarding if there was someone to share this journey with. And it's not just in business. It's everything in life as well. And so I think that's probably I was, it's part of my DNA and part of my personality to be, you know, introverted and very accustomed to and comfortable with being alone. And that's actually a good thing, to be able to be comfortable with your own silence and to be able to spend time by yourself and so on. But I think I may have stretched it too far sometimes in my life, when the right thing to do would have been to kind of seek help or to ask for advice or something like that.
Is there a specific situation that comes to mind when you say that?
Yeah, I think, for example, when I lost my wife, only a handful of people knew exactly what had happened. Everyone knew that she'd passed away, but no one really knew the details of what happened and how, you know, how painful it was at the time and the kind of moments that I lived, during that time. And I was very guarded about it. And I didn't feel like I wanted to share any of that. And it was just through, my good fortune that I ended up meeting in an event in Dubai. I ended up meeting Brandon Stanton, the founder of Humans of New York, who I was sat next to at a dinner table, and we ended up talking, and I was very intrigued about how he interviews people and how he's able to bring so much insight from complete strangers and so much emotion. I asked him how he does it, and he said that rather than telling me how he does it, he would share, he would ask me a few questions, and I get to see how he works. And, you know, after the first couple of questions, we were already very deep into the conversation. He's just had this kind of person that makes you feel very comfortable and want to share with him. And through that, you know, to cut a long story short, through meeting him, I ended up sharing my story with the world. You know, I wasn't quite, I knew that it was a big platform, but I didn't realize how big it was or how global it was. I thought it was very big in the US, but I didn't realize, I thought that when I was sharing it, that I would be shielded somehow from my home country, in the sense of, you know, it wouldn't be putting everything on the line quite in that way. But obviously I was wrong. And that was disturbing for me for a few moments when I came to that realization and saw how much it went viral and how many people back home were messaging about it and so on. It was a very, is an experience where you felt very naked, I suppose, like everything was out there. And but I came to realize very quickly that that was one of the best decisions that I've ever made. And somehow by sharing your story and by letting go of it in that way, you are able to elevate yourself in a way, and you're able to, you know, begin or at least advance quite a bit in the healing journey. And then immediately after that, my ultimate goal became, now that this guy has shared and told my story, it is my turn now to get on stage and share my own story. Public speaking has had, since Everest, had been a thing that I always that I fell into, something that I began to enjoy and love, and as a medium of sharing my ideas and thoughts. And so I knew that this would be the next thing. And eventually it happened a year later in 2016. I was on in the US at the a TEDx event in Oregon. And I shared my story with, 1,400 people in the audience. And obviously it was streamed and for thousands more. And that was a very healing journey, to be able to go out there and tell your own story. And do it justice and to go through that. I mean, even the journey of putting together the talk meant that I had to deep dive into so much emotions and so much trauma and so many things. So that's was something that, allowed me to do that. And this moment actually stands as one of the most moments that I felt proud of myself, because it was so difficult to do. You know, much harder than climbing any mountain or doing any of these things. And so, you know, that's, that came through just, realizing that there is really an importance with sharing the story.
It's very mind-opening. It's very beautiful that over time you have had your own journey of getting through things and getting to understand how you would cope up with everything that is happening and changing in your life from time to time. So it's actually very, very mind-opening.
I love that. You're very outspoken about a lot of causes, and we already mentioned that a bit, and you always link your journeys with a certain cause that you want to amplify. What is the closest cause to your heart right now?
I mean, so many things. I mean, I try to advocate to as many causes as I can. The ones that, I mean, there's a handful. The ones that are the closest to my heart, in no particular order, like, women's rights, advocating for the disruption and of traditional education, because I think it's something really important. Obviously, climate action, the plight of refugees, which we spoke about today, and also the rights of special needs individuals. All of these stories are, you know, I'm connected with in some form or the other. You know, special needs, obviously, because of my two sisters who passed away last year, and you know, I got to experience a whole lifetime with them, and got to see firsthand, you know, the how people lack understanding of like of who they are, and the sort of the lack of education awareness about that, and also the lack of opportunity. Refugees, we spoke about, I think, at length today. You know, climate action is something that, you know, there's no need for me to go into any details, but it's you know, it is one of the, not one of the, you know, two, three most pressing things that the world faces today. I think it's a cause that if we don't do something about in the next 10 years, I think that's the amount of time that we have. If no radical action, radical change happens the next 10 years, I think we're on a pretty sure path of a pretty bad path. Education, I mentioned education at first, and education is something that is, the world is growing at a very, very fast pace and changing at a very fast pace. And I don't believe that anything that we adults know that we can teach our kids that will prepare them for the world has to offer. The only thing that we can do is give them tools to be able to navigate the world, both from an emotional context, but also from a problem solving and analytical thinking context. But unfortunately, education is not necessarily built that way. We're still, unfortunately, even with the almost the end of the information age, we're still just doing our best to pack kids with information when they have all of this at the you know at their disposal in devices. So this is something that needs to also change, because it connects with everything that I've just mentioned, and obviously connects also with women's rights, because obviously a lot of the things that we suffer from are related to education in the household, parenting, but also, you know, what we receive in schools and what we tell our kids. This is obviously a grave situation, and is a cause that affects exactly sort of half the population. I say half just because most inequality in terms of sexual harassment or violence or anything is mostly a transgression against women. And I think we have a very, very long way to go. And I'm talking about Egypt, but I'm also talking about the world in general. And while there's a lot of work cut out for women to do, and there's a lot that has been done, and there's still a long way to go, I think, men, unfortunately, have only scratched the surface in terms of their responsibility, in terms of accepting their own privilege and listening properly to women's experience and women's point of view in that. And I think the two genders need to come together to meet at a certain point, because otherwise this situation, which is already has caused a lot of trauma and challenges and stuff, will end up being very explosive in the near future, which it already has. But there's so much work that needs to be there. So I've constantly tried to, whenever I can in my projects and my businesses, to embed elements of all of these causes in whenever I can, to attach myself to organizations that are doing far more work and better work than I could ever do. Like, for instance, the UNHCR or Equality Now, for example, with women's rights, or the Duke of Edinburgh Award for Climate Action. This is just an opportunity for somebody like me to be able to use my platform try to elevate the discussion. So I hope to do more of these things down the line. And there's still a lot more work to be done. There's a lot of cause for optimism in some of these things, some of the things that have been achieved over the past months and weeks and so on. But definitely there is so much more to do.
Amazing. And before we go, we have our quick round of rapid fire questions. We'll ask you five quick questions and you'll give us five quick answers. So Farida, start us off.
Yes. So, Omar, what's your favorite Nepali food dish?
Dal bhat, for sure.
Dal bhat, yes. I totally agree with that.
What's your favorite destination you've been to in the world?
Well, since I've talked about Nepal so much in the interview, I'm going to go different and say Peru.
Ooh, interesting.
Nice. In that case, what's your If Lost Find Me Here location?
Sinai.
Interesting. What's your favorite film or documentary?
Wow, it's a difficult one. Film or documentary? There's so many. It would be a long list. But I think maybe a film I think that I watched recently that had a tremendous impact on me was My Octopus Teacher, which I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's on Netflix. It's about a story of a guy who, reaches a point in his life where he's a bit lost and then revisits his childhood area somewhere, I think in South Africa by the ocean, and goes out to free dive and to snorkel and to do these things, and ends up coming across an octopus, and then over a period of a few weeks, months, develops a very strong relationship with this octopus in a way that human beings never thought that you are able to develop such kind of an intimate relationship with a creature that is very much considered by us humans as the closest thing to what we think is an alien would look like or behave like. And it just, to me, it's a very emotional story, and it just goes to show how we are all connected, regardless of how we look or how we operate, far, far more than we could ever know.
Well, it's very, very interesting. We'll definitely check it out. Okay, so last but not least, what is your favorite music genre?
That would have to be rap.
Oh, nice. Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Omar, for being a guest on this podcast. I think I'm very intrigued to explore nature, honestly, after this podcast. And I'm really excited for the guests to hear this one, too. So thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you. Thank you, Noran. Thank you, Farida. It was really enjoyable. And thanks for giving me the opportunity.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you so much to Omar Samra for joining us today and to my wonderful guest co-host Farida Sharawi. Farida, tell me what you thought. I know you and Omar have some similar mountain adventures. So, how was this episode for you?
It was very, very mind-opening, I can say that. I loved every single very little detail that he has mentioned in terms of how he connected with the culture and with the nature, and especially how dominant he is when it comes to him doing things or doing adventure for a cause. Because as someone, for me, that is very, very passionate about adventure and going out and climbing mountains and running marathons, I've always considered doing these adventures for causes that have good impact. So it's beautiful how Omar shared how is it like when one individual has so much positive impact, not only on a certain community or I would say a big number of people, but it could take only one person, one individual, to be positively impacted by all the causes and the adventures and the beautiful stories behind what Omar does. So yeah, I think it's, I would say it was a very mind-opening conversation.
I couldn't agree more. And as someone, like I mentioned in the episode, as someone who perhaps stays home way too often, I'm really excited to go out into nature and to see the wonders outside that maybe we don't explore as much, and I'm sure some of our audience will think so as well. Thank you so much again, Farida, for joining us for today's episode.
Thank you, Noran.
This has been the last episode of the first season of the Egyptian Streets podcast. We come back mid-June weekly, so stay tuned.
Egyptian Streets is a podcast produced for the independent online publication at egyptianstreets.com. The show is edited and produced by Noron Morsi. Production support from the Egyptian Streets team. Our theme music is The Zeppelin by Blue Dot Sessions. Tune in to the Egyptian Streets podcast every other Sunday, and don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. I'm Noron Morsi.